طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Our Palestinian voice this week is Amal Bishara, who is an anthropologist, author, and activist. Amal is associate professor of anthropology at Tufts University. She is a frequent visitor to the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, which is the home of her husband's family. Amal recently wrote an article which was published in the Journal of Ethnographic Theory, where she compared the differences in how the Palestinian population which lives in the occupied West Bank and the Palestinian population which lives in Israel conducted resistance through demonstrations, and how those differences reflected the reality of their lives. I sat down with Amal at the Radcliffe Institute, where she is currently a fellow, to discuss her article and the observations she made through her research. So Amal, you're an anthropologist and an activist. As an anthropologist and academic, you need to apply a kind of objectivity to your research and writing. We see that in your articles and books, the application of the discipline of academia to follow where your research takes you. But you're also an activist, a Palestinian with a sharp sensitivity to justice and the plight of the Palestinian people. And it's interesting to watch you navigate between those two passions in your life. And by the way, I think you do it very well.
It's kind of you.
You're both a student of Palestinian life and a participant in Palestinian life, which is to say a participant in the resistance, which defines much of the nature of Palestinian life. In your latest article in the Journal of Ethnographic Theory, you discuss the different realities of two Palestinian populations, those who live in the occupied West Bank and those Palestinian Arabs who live in and are citizens of Israel. You write about how demonstrations and acts of resistance reflect those two realities. And it's fascinating. I'd like to begin talking about some of the differences between the realities of life in the West Bank and those of Palestinians who live in Israel, and how those realities define their acts of resistance.
Well, so first of all, I would say that, and I think in some ways it's one of the complications of the project that I'm trying to do, which is exactly as you've described it, to look at Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank and what makes it difficult for them to speak to each other and also to speak as a collective. One of the things that makes that project difficult is that, of course, there's a lot of variation within each category, right? Yeah. You know, among Palestinians in the West Bank and among Palestinians in Israel. So even as I try to talk about sort of what, you know, what it means to live as a Palestinian in those two different contexts, of course, you know, it kind of, you know, you miss some of the variation within those two places. But in general, you know, Palestinian citizens of Israel are citizens, so they vote, and they have some of the privileges that come with having, you know, an Israeli passport in terms of, for example, travel and social services. But also Palestinian citizens of Israel are systematically discriminated against by the Israeli government. So there are more than 50 laws that discriminate against Palestinian citizens of Israel. And they, you know, range from, you know, laws about political participation to social and economic access to, you know, basically every field of life and law that you can think of. Also, Palestinian citizens of Israel are sort of on the peripheries of the Palestinian national project, right? Which is really, you know, centered in the West Bank. So, you know, they're not, when people, you know, for example, abroad think of the Palestinians, they don't think of Palestinian citizens of Israel. They really think generally, I think, either of Palestinian refugees or Palestinians in the occupied territories. So in some senses, Palestinian citizens of Israel are marginalized twice. First, as Palestinians in a state that defines itself as a state for Jews. And second, as Palestinian citizens of Israel in the Palestinian national movement, which does include them and has, you know, there's sort of been efforts to include, of course, all Palestinians everywhere in the liberation movement over the last decades. But nonetheless, Palestinian citizens of Israel remain on the margins of that project. And then you have Palestinians in the West Bank. You have Palestinians of the West Bank who are living, you know, under Palestinian administration through the Palestinian Authority, although differently, whether they're in cities or in villages or, you know, different locations within the West Bank, but they're also living under Israeli military occupation. So that military occupation drastically limits all of their rights, you know, to life, liberty, you know, to the right to gather, the right to move, right to life, you know, arrest rates can happen at any time of the day or night. You know, their ability to move between the West Bank and Israel, their ability sometimes to move from the West Bank to any other place in the world, you know, all elements of their lives are affected by military occupation.
Or even in Jerusalem. That's another whole reality is people in Jerusalem.
Great point.
Is it... is it safe to say, I don't want to push this too far, but is it safe to say that one distinction is that Palestinians living in the West Bank really, really face an occupation. They know what an occupation is. It's a military occupation. Uh-huh. Whereas Palestinians living in Israel face more of a discriminatory or segregated society, that they're fighting inequalities, but not the military in the same way that that those in the West Bank face the occupation. Is that...
I would say yes. Yeah. Yes, but, right? So Palestinian citizens of Israel actually lived under military occupation from 48 to 66.
Right.
So, you know, many people have memories of what it was like to live under military occupation. So, for example, my dad, I was walking with him. He's a Palestinian citizen of Israel. We're walking on the periphery of his village of Tarshiha. Hardly on the periphery, just right on the edge of town, but really within, you know, near the houses and buildings. And I said, so Dad, did you need a movement permit to come here when you were a kid? And he said, when I was a kid, we were allowed to be on this side of the street, but not on that side of the street without a movement permit. So, you know, also Palestinian citizens of Israel have experienced military occupation that is quite similar to the military occupation that we see in the West Bank and Gaza mm-hmm. after 1967. And the other thing I would say is that so there's that historical parallel. And the other thing is that, of course, the military occupation comes to affect Palestinian citizens of Israel also, right? So, you know, because Palestinians in the occupied territories are defined as the enemy and the outsider, that reflects back onto Palestinian citizens of Israel, and it increases the level of violence that Palestinian citizens of Israel face. So it is, in some ways, you know, legal discrimination mm-hmm. against them and, you know, racism against them as sort of an internal minority. Mm-hmm. But it's also augmented and shaped by the way in which they are associated with an external enemy.
And neither one can go into the other's territory. In other words, a Palestinian Israeli cannot pass into the West Bank. Is that right?
They usually can't go into Palestinian Authority areas of the West Bank that are under Palestinian Authority control. They can't go there legally, but they can go there. It's actually not difficult to go in.
Can they go there easier than a West Bank Palestinian can go into Israel?
Yes, yeah. Much, much, much easier. Much more easily.
Yeah. But what if you have a Jerusalem ID? How does that affect your ability to move?
So if you have a Jerusalem ID, you have an Israeli ID, right, that allows you to move between Israel and the West Bank like an Israeli citizen.
Okay, now...
Can I go back one,
sure.
one second? So I wanted to point out that when you're thinking about, you know, the way that the Israeli military occupation affects Israeli laws and society inside, you know, 48 Israel, I think you can make a parallel to the way in which, you know, U.S. occupations abroad and wars abroad have affected domestic politics here. You know, they've increased militarism and racism, right? However, in Israel, that is sort of even more intense because the, you know, the group of people that's the primary group of people that's discriminated against, and obviously there are others in Israel, is Palestinians, and they are also the same as the external enemy, right? You know, whereas in the United States, you know, you have in Israel also, obviously, you have migrants from Asia, you have, you know, Jews from a lot of different parts of the Arab world and the world that are discriminated against, and you have, you know, refugees from Africa and so forth, right? So Israel is also very complex, but the primary enemy is Palestinians, and they are the same, you know, as the primary minority inside Israel, right? And so sort of the way in which the external military occupations affect domestic politics and society is that much more intense. And even the word domestic becomes something that's really hard to define, you know?
Yeah.
Which is not as true in the United States.
Okay, let's talk about your research. You went and observed demonstrations. You sort of have observed acts of resistance in Israel, in Palestinian areas of Israel, Palestinian demonstrations, and then you've also observed and have a lot of experience with demonstrations and resistance in the West Bank, particularly Bethlehem, and I want to talk about that later. But so you made these observations, mm-hmm. and you drew some conclusions from that. So I talk about your article, because I found it fascinating.
Thank you so much. Well, so it happened that I was in Palestine in 2014 during the Gaza War, and for the months leading up to it. And I had a research project that I was doing that I, you know, really enjoyed and got a lot out of, but this sort of came up on the side because of the war and also because of the major strikes of the hunger strikes of prisoners and stuff. So I was going to a lot of protests in solidarity with prisoners and then against the war in Gaza in both Israel and in the West Bank. And they were mainly Palestinian protests, although I did go to some that you could say were sort of more inside Israel. I went to some protests that were more mixed Palestinian and Jewish, but most of them were sort of defined as Palestinian space. And that doesn't mean that there weren't Israeli Jews there. It just means that Palestinians were the ones who organized it.
They were
like
defining
that.
It.
Yeah. So, you know, the ones inside Israel, you know, were kind of more obviously comfortable for me as a person who grew up in the United States and who is used to American sort of political actions, right? You know, so they were protests where people were walking in the streets or standing in one place, holding signs and doing chants and, you know, maybe wearing, you know, a keffiyeh or wearing other kind of gear that sort of expresses something about your political view. Yeah. So that was pretty comfortable. Although it was also tense at certain times, you know, because there was a massive, you know, there were massive attempts to arrest protesters, particularly at a protest I went to in Haifa and stuff. But it was at least, it was much more recognizable to me as a, you know, a person who lives in the United States. In the West Bank, the protests were about direct confrontation with the Israeli army. And those kinds of protests happened every night during the Gaza War. And I should also say that in the West Bank, they would also have the kinds of protests where people were standing and holding signs or doing other kinds of, you know, activities like that. But the kinds of protests that kind of attracted the most attention and were seen as the hallmark form of protest by Palestinians in the West Bank were these direct confrontations with the military.
So what were some of the differences between the... You went to a protest in Lydda.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that. Describe the kind of signs that they had, the kind of protest it was, and how the police responded, and just sort of the general atmosphere of the of the protest, and then we can talk about when you went back. In fact, you went back that night, and there were some demonstrations in Bethlehem. And anyway, so let's talk about the difference between the two and the kind of signs that they had and the responses of the Israeli, whether they were soldiers on one side or police on the other.
Mm-hmm. So at this protest in Lid, there were people gathered in sort of the main square. And the interesting thing about it is that even the place names, the Palestinians who organized these protests used Palestinian place names to define where they're going. Even though those place names cannot be found on the map or on street signs anymore, right? Because these names have all been changed to be, Israeli and very, very deeply Zionist place names. So they would gather in the main park and they walk down the main street to another square. And, from the minute we gathered, there was police surveillance of us. However, there was also a counter demonstration a little bit away. Right. So I felt, frankly, that the police were absolutely surveilling us. And I know that some people were called into an investigation with police after, some Palestinian protesters were called in to be investigated after it.
Were there some Israeli, pro-Palestinian Israelis sort of as part of the demonstration?
Yeah, definitely.
And were they investigated then after it?
I don't know. I think there was only come a few leaders who were investigated. It wasn't, or I don't know actually exactly who was investigated, but I know that some people...
But they weren't treated any differently. I mean, they were all part of the whole thing. And then there was a pro-Zionist,
pro-war protest, yes. Right? And it was very energetic. And I have to say that, like, I felt this moment where I felt that the police were absolutely surveilling us. However, they were also, frankly, maybe I'm wrong, but I felt a sense of protection as well, which is that I would have felt less safe if they weren't there.
Yeah, yeah, they didn't want an incident. They clearly...
I knew I was being surveilled, but I also felt that
they were taking pictures and doing everything that they do here.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Now, I was at other protests where, Palestinians were arrested for protesting, and certainly I've been at protests where there was direct confrontation between protesters and the police, and, they included, police beating protesters and so forth, and using tear gas and so forth against protesters inside Israel. But at this particular one, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Were there protests besides at Lid where you were they all through Israel during the... During the bombardment of Gaza, so they were...
There were frequent protests, And I definitely noticed the surveillance at all of them.
And then compare that to the nature of the demonstrations in the West Bank, and particularly Ida Camp, that you know very well. Your husband's family is from Ida Camp. You go there every year with your family. It's your village... to a large extent, that's where you go. And Ida Camp is a particularly hot spot. It is up against the wall. It is right near Rachel's tomb, which is a sacred site to three religions, but available only to Jews, is my understanding. And there's a military base there, camp encampment there. And so it really is a hot spot. And we just hear day in and day out about what's happening in Ida Camp. The military comes in, the tear gas, the kids throwing stones, the resistance. Talk about the resistance in the Ida Camp.
Well, so let me, and I should have backed up to say one more thing about Lid, which was that I was amazed and inspired and blown away, really, by what it meant to be a part of that group in that place at that time. People were waving Palestinian flags and holding signs of, all kinds of signs against the war, but also the chants were really, really powerful. And, there was one chant that, went on for like a very long time, like 5 minutes. It was poetry in the streets, and it was a riff on a poem that dates back to the 1970s from the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And the way they kind of changed it around made it this poem that kind of called out to all these different Palestinian locations, to Gaza, to Ramleh, to Lid, to Mukhayam Balata, to Ain al-Halwa, to Kfar Bar'a, to all these Palestinian place names. And it was inspiring and beautiful because all of a sudden, you know, Lid is not the center of Palestinian life inside Israel. It's certainly not the center of Palestinian life writ large, right? You know, and yet all of a sudden these protesters from this one place are calling out all these place names, kind of evoking Palestine, evoking a Palestinian geography that has never existed concretely on the ground, right? Because they're also calling out to refugee camps in Lebanon and so forth, you know? So they're saying, we're all of these are Palestinian places and all of those people are Palestinians. And it's totally inspiring and moving, right? So that was amazing. And then in the West Bank, you go back and the chants and protests, the chants at the protests kind of take a back seat. they're kind of the prologue, but the real thing that's happening is the direct protest.
It's a confrontation.
Which was through stones, fireworks, primarily stones and fireworks, and sometimes other means like Molotov cocktails, but people tried not to use those at demonstrations because obviously they would make the rest of the demonstration so much more dangerous for everybody, and so people would criticize sometimes the use of Molotov cocktails or pipe bombs at these mm-hmm. protests because they would make participation way too dangerous. But it was stones and fireworks. And that, of course, is a kind of a bravery that is also inspiring, but in such a different way, right? Because these are people taking risks right then and there for their lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, they know that they can risk imprisonment, long-term imprisonment for these kinds of actions. And so for me, it was jarring and dizzying in some sense to move between these two contexts where such different things were counting as bravery and, you know, sort of two completely different ways to resist, basically. Each really bold,
right? You use
and moving.
Use it in your article. You use the term "the pen and the gun," mm-hmm. referring, I guess, to Lid being sort of resistance and the pen and the kind of resistance that they get in the West Bank.
Well, just to be very, it was the Israeli oppression. The Israeli oppression comes through the pen inside Israel, and the Israeli oppression comes through the gun in the West Bank. Although I also try to muddy that up, because
but the gun's the other way. I mean,
of the Israelis, exactly. The Israelis against Palestinians,
But that really is a very nice defining symbolism of the difference of what's going on in these two places.
And of course that line comes directly from, you know, a man I met whose house was under threat of demolition in Qalansawa, which is a village or a town in the Muthallath part of mm-hmm. Israel. And he said to me, Palestinians inside Israel, I can't remember the verb, but, you know, we're like, you know, we are kind of killed by the pen, and Palestinians in the West Bank are killed by the gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, in fact, the pen can be just as difficult.
Oh yeah, that's the discriminatory laws. That's the they control.
And that's what I think, in some ways, one of my goals—not my only goal, but one of my goals as an ethnographer—is to do that good listening, so that I'm listening to people who, you know, aren't going around giving lectures three times a week as professors of anthropology or anything else. Mm. You know, people who are living under, you know, threat every day of losing their lives. You know, they're sort of their lifestyle, right? He could be losing his house anytime. And yet he's also got a philosophy of politics that, you know, people can benefit from hearing, right? So as an ethnographer, I think that's one of my jobs, not my only job, to make sure that voices like that come to the fore a bit.
Yeah. It was interesting. I was in Lid at one point, and it's an interesting place because it was, before 48, very much an Arab-Palestinian mm-hmm. town. And it's taken over, and the people who lived in some very beautiful, very nice homes were driven out, and now the Palestinians really live in a ghetto. I mean, mm-hmm. they are segregated. Many cannot live in the homes that they grew up in, even though they're right there. And it's just, it's such a stark symbol of the discrimination and the segregation and the apartheid that takes place when you go to a place like Lid,
mm-hmm.
and we were there at a time when they had some beautiful homes had been built by Palestinians mm-hmm. and were set for demolition.
Wow!
And many of the citizens were sitting in a tent. You know, it's just sort of a resistance to this, and it was so stark. I'll never forget being in Lynn. Okay.
The home demolitions that are going on at an increased pace right now are really terrifying, and they're something that have always really shook me because it's such a personal loss, obviously, for a family or for a community, and yet it's also a loss for, you know, Palestinians as a collective. So yeah, they're terrible. And I don't know, but I have a feeling, because there was a demolition of a number of homes in Qalansawa very recently, and I expect that the person I spoke to lost his home in that demolition.
And then they can't rebuild. You can't get permits.
They can't get permits, right. He was building on his own land. His building is on his own land, but because it was zoned either for agricultural or industrial use, he's not allowed to build a house there. And so even though, you know, it's the only house that his family has.
That's the story again and again and again and again.
Exactly.
Yeah, we know the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions for years have been opposing that, and for years and years rebuilding 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times, sometimes the same. As we know, some people that they just build it every time it gets knocked down. And the toll that it takes on the family, on kids to see their home, again, I mean, it's hard to fathom.
Very hard to fathom. I mean, the work of Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian, she does an incredible job writing about this.
Yeah.
But I think, Al-Araqib, a village in the Negev, in the Naqab, has been destroyed over 100 times, right? And also this year, we've seen the destruction of Umm al-Hayran, a village.
Actually, we've talked about that a few times on This Week in Palestine. Nadia Ben Yosef. I remember she came back, and I think she was at Tufts or somewhere where we went and recorded her talking about the demolition of the village in the Negev. And the demolitions throughout the Negev just go on and on and on, with just one after another. It's unbelievable. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about, again, go back to Ida Camp and talk a little bit about the water project there. It's very tied up to what we're doing here, and I want to talk about the Walk for Water to raise money for it. But just get an update on it, because we've talked about that project a lot on This Week in Palestine. And so just spend a few minutes on that.
Yeah, so the water crisis for Palestinians takes many different forms. So for Palestinians in Gaza, for example, after 10 years of blockade and 3 major wars, the water is, and increased population density, very poor infrastructure. The aquifer is being polluted by both salt water and by sewage water. So, like, only 10% of Palestinians in Gaza have access to clean drinking water.
Gaza is terrible.
Yeah, and then parts of the West Bank, there are people who have much, much, much less availability of drinking water than they should have, because Israel, again, controls the amount of water that Palestinians have the access to. And that's definitely the case in Ida refugee camp, where, you know, there have been times when Palestinians in Ida refugee camp go, 2 months without having water piped through the networks. So they store water on rooftop tanks. And when that water runs out, they have to buy it, which is, very, very expensive for them. And also storing water in tanks can lead to health problems, because the chlorine evaporates, and then there's a possibility, of course, of contaminants and, bacteria growing there. So it presents a health risk for people.
And most of the water comes from under the West Bank. So technically it's their water, but it's taken by Israel and then sold back to them, I understand, at 4 times the price that they sell water to Israelis.
So Israel takes much of the water and gives it to people inside Israel, and then also much of it goes to settlers, and only a small percentage is left for Palestinians, even though it's from the West Bank aquifer. So one of the exciting and inspiring thing that's going on with regards to water and One for Three, which is an organization based here in Boston and working on water and environmental issues in the West Bank and especially in Ida, has been to build a rain collecting cistern. And rain collecting cisterns, of course, are part of Palestinian history. This is how Palestinians made it through the summer.
It's very ancient, actually.
Yeah.
Way back. I mean, Romans. I mean, you're way back. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is sort of just making the old new again and collecting water from the rooftop of a community-based organization, and which is called Lajet Center, and storing it in a new cistern that is on, you know, I think the construction is complete.
Oh, is it?
I believe it's complete, but if not, it's almost complete. It's definitely under construction.
Great.
And that water will be used to alleviate water shortages for residents and also for the operation of the center itself. And it's also a model so that people can come and see how this kind of a cistern can, you know, ease the water shortage.
So that's water for, that's not drinking water.
Actually, apparently they are going to, yeah, treat
really?
It. That's what my understanding is, yeah.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just gray water then, it's...
That's the plan for this cistern, yeah. And it's exciting because... you know, I mean, again, if Israel is controlling the water that's under the ground, what's left? You know, the water that comes from the sky. And, you know, so using that smart, you know, using mm-hmm. that resource well is a really exciting thing. And I think that, you know, for people in Ida, you know, there's been that water and these increased attention to issues around the environment has... One for Three has also been able to build rooftop gardens that allow families to have access to vegetables that they're growing. So they know, for example, that there aren't chemicals on them. And actually, when I talk to people about vegetables in the West Bank, there's a lot of talk about what chemicals are being used on their produce, right? And also about how fresh their produce is. And, you know, for people who love good vegetables, you know, that's a real problem, right? Or who want their children and themselves to be healthy and to know that there are no chemicals on their produce, right? So the fact that people are able to build to grow so much on their own rooftops is a really exciting thing.
Was there any trouble with permits to build the cistern? Was that ever an issue?
The permit would not be obtained from the Israelis because it is in Area A.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Big difference.
Yeah, right. Very big difference.
Because
yeah.
that's exactly the kind of thing that when they have control, they will not allow this. And,
I just saw a map of the wells and cisterns that have been destroyed by Israel in recent years, but I don't have the statistics on the top of my head, but it would be good to check it out.
No, because controlling the population, which is what they're all about, mm-hmm. Is often done by... shooting the water tanks, mm-hmm. you know, making life so miserable, and shooting, so they lose the water in the tanks. And so that's a real weapon for Israel. That's
yeah.
a weapon that they use.
And for me, sort of the collaboration between One for Three and Lajet, which is the community-based organization in Ida refugee camp, that collaboration is about water and is kind of providing that concrete value of access to water and then the rooftop gardens. But it's also about kind of a broader statement, which is that we can help remake our space into a healthier place for all of us, right? You know, we have the resources. We can do this together. You know what I mean? Right. Because Israel is trying to take away, you know, limit access to water and also just limit access to a healthy environment in a million different ways, as we know, right? And this is to say we can take the small step together to rebuild our environment so that we can thrive in it as well as we can under the circumstances. So that's what, to me, it's like a mixture of something that is sort of a humanitarian thing, but it also is connected to a political statement about how we can retake power in our own communities.
Yeah.
And I have to say that that's what's exciting to me about the Walk for Water, too, is that it is about a humanitarian impulse of raising money for those projects, but it's also about creating a space for people to walk together to support a healthy environment there and here and access to water there and Palestinian rights right here in our own you know, city,
right?
And to do that together. And we all know the power of protest, and we're seeing that more and more, right? So it's
yeah, we have the work of the Water Alliance, which
yeah.
is a whole group, and working together around the issue of water is so important because the education value is enormously important, I think.
I have learned a lot as a scholar, because the heart of my work is not at all about, is not about water. The heart of my work is not about water. But so I've learned a lot from the activists here about water that I take back to my scholarship. So I think that it's incredible cross-fertilization that I'm so grateful for. Mm-hmm. And I've been especially grateful for, you know, since the elections and during the elections, you know, to know that I have, that we have built a great community that supports Palestinian rights and the rights of refugees and immigrants and people of color, you know, has been a great gift to me in the last months.
So the Walk for Water is April 22nd, which is a Saturday, going to be on a Saturday morning. We're looking for people to walk. We're looking for people to volunteer.
And raise money.
And raise money. And raise money as walkers. And they can get information about that at onefor3.org.
onefor3.org. Yeah.
And there's a way to sign up and learn about it
and learn more about these projects.
And more.
Yeah,
more
about it should project. Be a really great day.
Yeah, it should be. Well, Amal, thank you for the time that you've taken to talk with us on This Week in Palestine.
Thank you for all that you do.
We try.
You're incredible, John, this energy.
And hope you keep up your good work in academia. And I know you'll keep up your good work as an activist.
Thank you. It's very kind.
That we know. That's a given.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. That was a conversation with Tufts Professor Amal Bishara, recorded at the Radcliffe Institute, where she is currently a fellow. We end this morning with some excerpts from Amal Bishara's article, her conclusion, which summarizes the findings of her research. Amal concludes, and I quote, "Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank resist Israeli rule with different approaches, even as they draw on a shared heritage of resistance. In Israel, the primary forms of public opposition to the 2014 Gaza War were vigils and processions, with a few demonstrations involving confrontation with Israeli police. In contrast, while people in the West Bank held vigils, they poured most of their energy into direct confrontation with the Israeli army. When one larger protest in Nazareth, inside Israel, erupted into stone throwing, I heard different explanations among Palestinians in the West Bank than among Palestinian citizens of Israel. The former praised the step. The latter said that it had been Israeli undercover officers who instigated the violence to make the protest more dangerous. However, on other occasions, Palestinian citizens of Israel argued that Palestinians there should also open lines of direct confrontation, and that when they did, this would be even more effective than similar protests in the West Bank. As one activist inside Israel explained, "We just do not have the culture of resistance to make this happen now." Palestinians' inability to express themselves collectively across these two communities is partially due to Israel's closure policies, which limit actual co-presence. But it is also due to Israel's different communicative restrictions on these communities, which yield distinct approaches. What looks like a successful protest in each place is quite disparate. Fragmentation in geography and political culture is a key factor producing Palestinian subalternities, compounding the obstacles to expression that come from either being a minority excluded from the national project, as are Palestinian citizens of Israel, or being subjects of military occupation, as are Palestinians in the West Bank. The more general point, then, is that state-produced divisions between related polities
affect conditions for group expression. It is not only that states set limits for political expression in a variety of ways, it is also that naturalized sense of separation between people into different polities, in this case, Israel and the West Bank, acts as another limit on expression. The differences between two Israeli modes of repression multiply their effectiveness. This is one key dimension by which the state produces publics, counterpublics, and their norms. It may at first seem as though these two Palestinian groups have different goals. Palestinian citizens of Israel seem to be seeking to articulate a shared identity as Palestinians, while Palestinians under occupation, their national identity firmly established, seem to be struggling for territory. It may seem that chanting and stone throwing are quite different forms of resistance. However, both saw protesting for Palestinians in Gaza during the war to be of crucial importance, worth significant risks. Though they never protested together, when they did chant, they used similar words. Each of these protests constituted a collective subject serially and intertextually with other protests that year and across the decades of Palestinian resistance. The forms their resistance took differed somewhat, but each form of resistance was a means through which Palestinians worked through the ideas about Palestinian collectivity and Israeli violence. The predominantly linguistic and the predominantly bodily or protests dominated by embodied talk and those dominated by physical action are intimately related. They are ways to explore the same themes. They are by no means polar opposites. Indeed, we need to insist on recognizing the embodied in speech and in the semantic in action, and the ways they blend, augment, or contradict each other in single performances. When we look at speech as embodied and emplaced and recognize the performative in a wide variety of protests, the relationships our practices of resistance can become clearer. So concludes Professor Amal Bishara. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on that archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.